llamado Ego Mickey Hart, one of two drummers for the Grateful Dead. It was impressive watching those men play simultaneously. You know, you just think, how? And someone once asked Mickey in an interview, you know, why don't more bands do this? Right? The effect is fantastic. He said, well, it's not easy. Everybody's got to really know what they're doing, and the drummers have to be synced up. I can tell you, it is among the great pleasures of the physical plane to make rhythm with people who are good at it and who, you know, find the groove, and then you're just in this other reality. And the Grateful Dead were certainly another reality, and there are some recordings, so I'm listening to the tone quality of the drums thinking, this is like sex. This is so pleasurable to hear. And I posted to Facebook saying one of my, like, you know, 3 a.m. two bong hit exclamations on Facebook. And Drexel Najarian, an old and good friend of mine and a great friend of Planet Waves, responded with this detailed article on the miking techniques of the Grateful Dead drum kit. So apparently it is an entire science of how to get the drums to sound that good. And, you know, Mr. Applied Science himself, Mickey Hart, was involved, maybe entirely involved. Owsley and others, anyway, getting that sound right. All right, so Mickey, like Alan Watts, big Neptune in this chart, that being a Neptune-Mercury conjunction, and then his Virgo consists of Sun, Venus, and Chiron, all in Virgo, squared by Mars. So when I got the feeling that he was carrying a lot of tension in that little body of his, and he is someone I know from hearing legends of the road, not afraid to express when he thinks you're a fucking jerk. So not an inhibited person, and certainly one of the true collective of virtuosos in the Grateful Dead. When you start to hear the backstory on how and what these people did to learn music and where they came from, Philip Lesh, a co-member of the rhythm section of the Grateful Dead, was composing a musical piece for five symphony orchestras when he met Jerry. That's what he was doing. He was some kind of a oboist or something like this, like nothing like the bass guitar, and Jerry met him and liked him and said, hey, I want you to play bass for us. And Phil's like, I don't play bass. And Jerry basically said, we'll learn. And he did. And then like 2 weeks later, Tina Weymouth, similar scenario. All right, so here we are, way at the back of the program, tucked away, Tantra Studio. The portion of Planet Waves FM where I talk about and would be happy to have you talk about. I know that not everyone wants to open their mouth and talk about these things with anyone, but I do my best to give you language and ideas and frame the subject matter in ways and express how you may ground the subject matter. Tantra, in my definition, being the discussion of and practice of existence using sex and sexuality as its central metaphor. So I compare it to astrology, which is a study in reality using the planets as its metaphor. Herbalism, a study in reality using plants as its reference frame. And if you just go back like one page of herbalism, you find out that it's best friends with astrology through this thing called the Doctrine of Signatures. Homeopathy being a study in reality using all substances, whether it's, you know, donkey semen, whale milk, you know, whatever it might be, as its substances, its container is anything with physical form or that you can infuse with water. That's homeopathy. And Tantra, the least known of all of these, is a study of reality through sexuality. And sex is important because it creates us all. And it is frequently left out of or banned from the conversation, or the way that we practice sexual censorship in our time is that we politicize sex. And there's just no fun to that. And it's always about making someone else wrong. And when you hear the concept of rights associated with sexuality, you can be sure that no one is wet or has a hard on. It's all about a fight rather than a meeting of people willing to reason and encounter one another, have an experience of one another. And I have not yet conducted a full treatment of the entire COVIDian cult phenomenon simply as an anti-sex movement. But you don't need to look very far to understand that social distancing is not only anti-sex, it is antisocial. It should be called antisocial distancing. That being afraid of other people's bodies is anti-sexual. I mean, when you list off all the things you do in sex and all the different ways of exchanging DNA and breath and body fluids and all of this stuff and uninhibited ways in which people can explore one another physically, emotionally, and aesthetically, to create the idea that everyone around you has a body that's a disease vector, and that's all really it's good for, is a disease vector, is not fun. There's no love or pleasure in that whatsoever. In fact, it's downright terrifying. And I think there needs to be a real conversation about the way in which this obsession with physical fear and this like perseveration, this mania, this OCD quality obsession with hygiene theater, what influence that has had on our ability to relate socially and sexually, which are conjoined twins. To relate socially is to relate sexually. It's just whether it is emphasized or expressed or not, but it's always right there among people. There's always curiosity running around, and no matter what people's actual whatever their claim status is, people are curious about one another. And now suddenly we have basically been told that we're all a bunch of disease vectors and dunked in 50 different kinds of disinfectant and separated from one another, jammed apart from one another. During the original lockdown, I was not hiding my view that I thought that quote-unquote social distancing was one of the stupidest things I'd ever heard of, most ridiculous attempts at a medical intervention, obviously a psychological operation to make people nervous. And someone wrote to me and said, "You must be a sex addict if you don't like social distancing." And I'm thinking, when was the last time I had sex in Walmart? I wonder if I'm propositioning someone, I can do it from 6 feet. Hey, hey, you over there in the cold cereal aisle. And now we are, many of us are confronted by, who understand what is in these injections and what they are said to do and what the script is, what that mRNA is instructing the cells to do, which is to spew out trillions of spike proteins, not attenuated spike proteins. This is the thing. This is so not a vaccine. I'm not, I know we're not in the COVID portion of the program, but I must say this. The antigen in the COVID vaccine, the thing that provokes the immune response, is said to be the spike proteins created by the DNA or mRNA instructions to tell your cells to make, to help make this completely unnatural thing. And normally, that thing being an antigen, it's supposed to get the immune system to respond and make antibodies, but that's only one part of immunity is antibodies. There's all kinds of immunity. There's T-cell and memory T-cell and B-cell immunity and macrophages and all this stuff, and none of that's addressed by any of this. But the most demented thing about all of this is that these spike proteins are not attenuated. When they inject people with polio, you're supposed to be attenuated polio. Rabies shots are supposed to be attenuated, meaning stepped down, neutralized, only the bare minimum to create the immune response. I think this whole theory is completely for shit, by the way, and I've studied it, I get it, and I have listened, and I've read the homeopathic literature that to me makes much more sense, and even though they're rooted in the same concept, and the concept of attenuating the virus is similar to the concept of potentizing the arsenic in the homeopathic pharmacopoeia. It's to take the thing and to have it have a minimum medical effect to get the desired medical result. The spike proteins created by the body of a person who's had the injection are not attenuated spike proteins. They are full-strength spike proteins that can do all the damage that an infection with so-called COVID is said to be able to do. But the problem with SARS-CoV-2 infection, if you believe all of those things exist in one sentence or not, is that your body makes spike proteins. That's the dangerous thing, they tell us over and over again. Well, what does the injection do? The injection just gets you to make spike proteins. Not minimally toxic spike proteins that your body then mounts an immune response against. No, full strength spike proteins. It's nuts. All right. So thanks for enduring that discussion during the sex portion of our program. I'm planning to, go down a path that may be challenging for some. And I've been thinking about how I haven't done much lately about polyamory. And way back at the beginning, the two subjects the Planet Waves was talking about back when it wasn't all that popular to talk about them, and certainly not on an astrology website, were masturbation and polyamory. Masturbation being solo sex or shared solo sex, and polyamory being the idea that people have multiple attractions, multiple lovers, multiple partners. Whether that's serial monogamy, which I call serial polyamory, because it's poly and it's serial. It's one after the next, after the next, after the next. If you could call that serial monogamy, but that would only work if you didn't bring all the people, put them together in one room, right? All 20 of the people somebody was serially monogamous with, it would be serial polyamory. And masturbation being a form of sex that is inherently supposed to be or said to be, believed to be solitary, but which I think is a social or potentially social form of sex, and one that is the portal to a functional, workable, accessible, fairly easy dimension of sexual healing. That a lot of the work of sexual healing can be done because sexual feelings have to be involved, sexual ideas have to be involved. Well, we've got access to sexual ideas and sexual feelings through masturbation. And that all that's between that and being social is a taboo. A lot of, shit talk about evil and guilt and how it's not real and how it's offensive and so forth. And till fairly recently, and I'm sure for some people, the idea that their partner might masturbate is reflective to them of being inadequate, of being sexually inadequate. And this enters the polyamory discussion as well, because the thing that makes polyamory inaccessible, polyamory meaning open, honest, communicated non-monogamy, as opposed to the usual, which is either cheating, meaning you don't have an honest conversation, or serialized polyamory, where you have a relationship and then you end the relationship and you move on and you have a new relationship, and you, that's performing a function of polyamory, which is exploring the diversity of possibilities that people are capable of. That's partly what you're doing in polyamory, is that you're experiencing the diversity of the human experience, and you're experiencing the diversity of your own capabilities. And one of the early Book of Blue New York models, a woman named Hannah, on a photo shoot, we were up out on the land and talking about stuff while we were taking pictures, and she said, "Well, everyone would be polyamorous if they weren't worried about making their partner jealous." Yeah. And with that, a lot of what when I listen to what people are saying and hear the stories of attempts at polyamory and all this, is you do something that you're worried will make your partner jealous, which is a special emotion. Jealousy is not like, you know, ouchie, you know, it's a whole other, like, existential level thing, very tantric subject for that reason. But then also being terrified that someone's going to do something that's going to make you jealous, right? Well, and there you have a lot of people who are like, "Well, I do what I want, and you'll deal with your jealousy, but don't you dare make me jealous." And it's these kind of essentially hypocrisies that I think need to get brought to the light and talked about and ironed out in order for there to be actual sexual healing. And my primary teacher on jealousy is a guy named William Pennell Rock, planetwaves.net/jealousy.html, one of the oldest pages on Planet Waves. Used to be the first thing that came up in a Google search under the word jealousy, which is a big word. planetwaves.net/jealousy.html. And his spiritual name is Swami Anand Virajwar, very high Swami under Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, and was involved for many, many years. And his Western studies are incredible. I mean, really erudite guy who then took a spiritual path as his primary life vocation. Still on the planet. He's in his 80s and doing videos, and seems quite robust for a guy in his 80s. Really, like, lives in a teepee on his own land, where I visited once. And he breaks down what topics you have to think about to understand jealousy. Like, what's the issue here? What's really going on in jealousy? And as I understand it, having read this article and practiced it many years, I was given a copy of it in the summer of 1992. So I've had 29 years, one entire Saturn cycle, to think about this, and had it, you know, made it available generally on the internet, and it's been republished many times. We think of jealousy as just being a feeling or an emotion, but what Pennell is saying is it's much more complicated than that, and that what's really going on in most jealous episodes is based on the fact that people tend to create relationships around which they build their entire identity. So if someone's entire identity is based on a relationship, if their partner then even so much as expresses feelings for another person or has an experience of another person, the entire personality structure that they have built, which is not just the relationship. Many people build the entire structure of their psyche around a relationship, right? You understand what I'm saying? I don't know quite how to metaphorically say this, but that's just what happens a lot of times. When someone else does something that would in some way seem to betray the relationship or show interest outside of it, it's not just the person's feelings that are hurt. It's not just that there might be some form of a betrayal. And it doesn't have to be a betrayal. You can say exactly what you're doing, but that can even be taken as a betrayal. But the end result is not a feeling they don't like, but the sensation of their entire identity collapsing because it was based on the relationship. That there's a lot of ways this can happen. But jealousy and jealous episodes are one of them, and so too is the constant ongoing suspicion that someone is quote-unquote cheating. This person's cheating. And that when a person suspects someone is cheating, what they're saying is, I am ungrounded in who I am. I am not capable of trust. And many, many times when someone believes someone's cheating, they are not doing so. And many times when people are absolutely convinced their partner has perfect fidelity, there's something going on. And notably, in my experience, which mainly has involved hearing about people's relationships since I first started reading tarot cards in the 1980s, and then attending teaching at many polyamory and tantra conferences in the late 90s through the mid 2000s, this is not a male thing or a female thing. This is not about, as Ogden Nash said, higamous, hogamous, women are monogamous, hogamous, higamous, men are polygamous. That's a cute poem, right? You read that once, you never forget it. It's not true. There's no truth to it. It is pure narrative. It is press release. And part of the press release is to conceal the behavior that would reveal that women are not these idyllic, pure things that we are told over and over, sugar and spice and everything nice. Women are people. People are people. And the narrative, only men are interested, does not hold up to any scrutiny at all, whatsoever. And this is demonstrated in many ways, and I early in my career writing about polyamory, I would hear, well, you're just a guy. That's why you are. That's why you're interested in that. Well, how about all the major leaders of the poly movement, the founders of the poly movement? Let's see, Deborah Annapole, Ryan Nearing, who I both miss both of these women dearly. Deborah passed away years ago. Ryan, I haven't heard from in a long time. And then Robin Trask, who took over Loving More magazine when Ryan and Brett sold it, major leaders of the founders of the poly movement. A guy who's been a guest on the program before, I would love to have him back. I'm not sure if this recording has survived the website move. We lost some recordings, some very early Planet Waves FM recordings. A guy named C.T. Butler, a dude, okay, but real grounded in his feminine sensibilities, was what he said, Johnny Polyseed, going up and down the East Coast from town, city to city, setting up poly groups. Stay in town for a month, set up a poly group, move on, go to the next town, up and down the East Coast. Okay, he's a guy, but most of the rest of the founders of the American poly movement were women. And so, again, you can't just say, well, this is just a guy thing. What it comes down to is a willingness to be real and a willingness to do something which most people find is challenging. You know, what serially polyamorous people do, in my view, is they have a relationship and they experience a facet of themselves in the relationship, and they do a certain amount of becoming and finding themselves in the relationship, and then they're ready for something else, and then that means changing partners, and then they go to another partner around whom they build their sense of identity and their life, and then that relationship either changes or becomes disillusioning, and then there's another partner. And how many people do you know who actually stop having relationships for a while between relationships, who pause and reflect on their life and do their thing? Now, apropos of that, there's another phenomenon of people who experience a relationship, and then the Bjork song, "It's Oh So Quiet," is well, we will hear from Bjork shortly. The sun will soon be in Scorpio. There's a big thing in the relationship and falling in love, and people surrender their anima to the woman or their animus to the man, and they have their identity completely wrapped up in the other person, and then that ends, and then they go back to being themselves, and they do all the things that they would do when they're not in a relationship. And I play guitar, I sketch, I like to write in my journal and take walks in nature and hang out with my friends, and all those things that quote unquote being in a relationship mean you can't do because your time is signed on for and you can't hang out with certain friends and certainly your male friends in many relationships, though maybe this is changing. As men and women start to succumb to being denatured by political propaganda, maybe people are not generally showing much interest. A large number of people are generally not showing much interest in sex. Maybe people are not quite so threatened, but I don't know. There's a lot of possessiveness that goes on, and there's not many women who are in relationships who are free to socialize with whatever men they want to socialize with. And the reason for this is what Pennell is saying about how relationships are constructions around which we build our entire identity. And when that identity is threatened because the relationship in some way is seen to be something other than the illusion that it's perpetuating, the person can really panic and feel like, oh my God, what have I got? I've got nothing. I'm losing everything. Where was she this morning? I tried to call. She wasn't there. What's going on? That's on the person having the experience. It is often blamed on the person who just went out. You made me jealous. You hung out with Bill. You're not supposed to see Bill. We talked about this. You can't hang out with your ex-boyfriend or this some new person that you met or whatever. How do you feel about that person? Or I see the way you're looking at that waitress in the sushi restaurant or whatever else might be coming up. This is not about the person checking out the hot server's ass in the sushi restaurant. It's about the person having the jealous reaction. This is step one in the process, not only of healing jealousy, but of totally transforming one's relationship such that your identity is created as something built around you, your experience, your life. That you don't surrender your identity to so completely to someone else that should there be the meekest vibration of possible change in that you panic and feel like you don't exist. So this is where the study of jealousy is an existential study. It's a study in being. It's a study in existence. And here's where jealousy becomes a fabulous teacher. When I had a kind of pick a career path as a presenter in the Pali and Tantra scene, I picked the two that I thought were the most relevant to the entire thing and that nobody else was doing. And the first one was masturbation. At the time that I got involved, there was no one else specifically presenting in the Pali scene. Then it was a little bit of a new thing. Betty Dodson had been in business for a long time, and I had just met her and kind of got the go ahead from her to like, sure, do it, And the other one was jealousy and compersion. So you go to a Pali conference, at least in the old days, and there's a lot of talk about the school board and cohabitating and the influence on children and how you organize your relationship life. And do you do the primary secondary type relationships, or do you do more of an intimate network type relationships, or are you pan-fidelitous? You have multiple partners that go on for decades, that kind of thing. And I'm like, okay, that's interesting. These are some cool panels. I'm glad people are dealing with this, or, you know, addressing like the fact that the school board may try to take your kids away if they find out that there's two couples raising one child. Based in truth, that's actually happened. And so, like, if United States, you know, for all the free country bullshit they feed us, well, let's say two couples want to raise one child. There's nothing inherently harmful about that. Two couples where people work and they give the attention to the kid, and the kid's got clothing and food and love and attention and a dry bed to sleep in, and they've got support and love and people to go to the PTA meeting. Well, you can practically be prosecuted for that. If somebody's got a bug, if somebody's got the morality bug up their ass, they can call Child Protective Services, and there can be a whole freaking scene when all you're doing is minding your business and taking care of your child. So all of that, like, I'm glad people are doing that. My approach was, well, without compersion, there's no polyamory. You can't have polyamory where people are having jealous episodes. It's just not going to work. You can't do it. You can try, but it's going to be a rolling disaster. And the rolling disaster is the disaster of people's jealous episodes, which are based on their lack of self-awareness, their lack of self-development, their lack of self-esteem. That's what jealousy is. You could say, well, it's perfectly natural emotion. Sure, it's a perfectly natural emotion. But if somebody writes an article I think is better than one of my articles, and I'm like having a rage about it, like that's not too much self-esteem or self-development. Heck, I love when people do things better than I can, because I got something to aspire to. So this is where compersion comes in. Compersion is loving the experiences of other people. Compersion is respecting your partner's individuality enough to want them to have the love and the feelings that they want. Now, this is a true high tantric journey, but it's like right down to the hot bed of coals that you have to walk on to get there, because it is like doing that. There's a defiance of gravity in there, but what is really going on in cultivating compersion, which is a kind of Buddhism of sex, somewhere, and I hope this too is not in the missing files, I gave a talk called Community and Compersion, which essentially describes the polyamorous path of compersion as a kind of a Buddhist path where you have empathy for all living things, meaning you have empathy for the sexual needs and desires and pain of all people. It's not just about you. And you think of, on this path, what I explain and practice is, you don't treat people as if they are the one focus ever. You respect the fact that many lovers and loves pass through people's lives. That's the reality of the situation. You can pretend it's going to be you and me forever, and it may not be very romantic to acknowledge that relationships, one way or the other, that relationships are transient. They may tap into something eternal. They may teach you about something eternal. But ultimately, human relationships in our immaculate bodies are transient relationships. Well, this is daring territory for many people to meekly even go there. However, the other way to look at that is, well, the truth is that this person I'm looking at has had several or many, and people like to downplay it. You always say three, right? That's the millennial thing. How many people have you had sex with? Three. Oh, sure. Three. Couple of people. I've had sex with three people. That's it. Is to recognize that you are part of a person's life journey. They are part of your life journey. and to embrace the truth that their life journey has included many people and may very well include many other people, and that there are many who love them and many who they love. And so the thing about polyamory is that it is said to be controversial and experiences controversial for many people, but it would not be controversial were it not a thing commonly yearned for, that happens in ways that are usually toxic because they are deceptive. That's the thing. There's a book called Bringers of the Dawn by Barbara Marciniak, a Pleiadian channeling, one of my favorite channeled works. And in there, whoever these Pleiadians are, I like Marciniak's version of the piece the best. And they say, you know, humans are not monogamous. Everybody knows this. This is plain to see that humans are not monogamous, but they have a little maturity problem. Humans have a little maturity problem. They're not so able to be honest with each other. And so therefore, they say, this isn't, I don't know when this was channeled, probably in the 80s. At this time, monogamy or the attempt at monogamy is the best thing to do. The problem with that is that we still have feelings, no matter how, you know, deeply in love and you know, all the things that people say and fully, totally devoted and, oh my God, we have kids and, you know, she's got the little baby sling and he's got the perfectly trimmed beard and the very tidy baseball hat and, you know, we're in love and going to be a family forever. The fact is people have feelings and for other people, and they're noticing other people all the time and they're meeting people for whom they have feelings. And there's very few things that get people interested in people like them having a partner. Now, what's that about? You could say that's about the lack of availability, or you could say that it's about biological things like sperm competition, or that someone in a relationship where they're happy is more open and that draws people in, and that there is a natural community that would build where people honestly experience one another in a diversity of sexual ways. But that doesn't threaten all of known reality. And that can be done. It has been done many times. There are things that get in the way. And the first thing that gets in the way is someone in the midst of all that putting their foot down and having a jealous episode. Or someone doing something that they're not honest with the people that they're intimate with about that. So we've got a few things to cross, but I think that the first and most important one is, and this is my takeaway from Pennell after reading this article for 29 years and meditating it and contemplating on it, but the ideas are in there in the text, but this is the way I'm saying it, is that the jealous episode is about the total over-identification with the lover that is threatened when the lover is either thought to do something, suspected of doing something, actually does something, wants something, feels something, anything like that. The problem is not so much a problem in relationships as it is a problem of how people choose to identify themselves, how they build their ego structure. And what I have learned, and the thing that's a little weird about me, is that I am a self-contained unit. My ego structure is a self-contained thing. I don't depend on the existence of others as my primary means of thinking that I'm a real person and or that I'm in some way valid or loved or something like this. And it can be lonely, but the thing is that despite that, because it sort of takes me out of the normal dating thing, right? It's just like, you know, whatever. That's another story. I'm willing to have it if I can get a good conversational partner, and there may be one who is willing to play on that topic. But I'll tell you that it is challenging, but it is worth it. It is in the end, it is about being your own person. It's about always being available to the experience that is in front of you. And it doesn't mean that you're obliged in some way to have that experience, but the availability is very important. The sense of being open and acknowledging and not being like, well, you're very nice, but I can't just do this. I can't think about you that way. I'm like, yeah, your tongue's in her pussy. Don't worry, you're thinking about her with that mind of yours or whatever the transaction might be, the exchange might be. You are thinking about each other that way. So to loop this back around to masturbation, here's why I think that a fantastic way to practice compersion is for people who trust each other to start to open up about their sexual fantasies to one another. And not to open up about their sexual fantasies like they're filling in a tax form. You know, just, well, I do like Jim. I'm attracted to his manliness and no. What do you do? Like, you know, well, that's my kind of girl. No, like, what do you like about her? And to bring that out into the room and experiment with the experience, the actual experiment of meeting the people you care about where their feelings are. And what you might find in that journey is you got some opening up to do about how people feel about you to accept that, because that too can be an imposing thing. Like, wow, this person really cares about me. And there's a lot of growth in relationships when it comes down to that recognition that person really cares about me, and to be open enough to receive. In a sense, it is all the same thing. There are just whole segments of whole like facets of this reality that are left out because they are said to be taboo, improper, threatening of the social order. Everybody who either experiments with any form of previously gayness, bisexuality, transsexuality, depending on when we're talking about, or polyamory, has been told at some point they will be responsible for the fall of Western civilization. Well, Western civilization is falling, and I'm happy to tell you that it has nothing to do with anyone being polyamorous, or for that matter, same-sex preference. No. This is where we build society. The relationships that form when people have compersion for one another, in my experience, are truly enduring relationships that have gone through some degree of uncluttering of ego obsession and attachment. And when one is a whole self-contained person, that opens up entirely new experience of loving and of being loved. And it takes practice and it takes courage more than anything. It takes being a genuinely moral person, not just someone who has the appearance of morality, who, you know, would pass muster at the church dinner among all the other moral people. And they're generally not in any way preaching any form of morality. We're saying people are people. We have the feelings we have. We live in a world of beautiful, attractive people. And yeah, I know it's not 100% and all that, but there's someone for everyone. But boy, no matter what your tastes are, there's a good few people who will at least get your attention. You may at least be crushing on for a while, wish you could experience them in some way. That's natural. And for people to coexist like that, well, that's where real trust comes in. And that's where the real adventure comes in, and where there needs to be, in my view, a really special kind of loyalty. And also an understanding that, for at least for me, I'm not the be-all and end-all for anyone, especially. And if someone treats me that way, I respect and love and am open to that, but I am not perceiving myself in someone's life as the be-all and the end-all and the other. And plus, I'll wrap up on this note, curiosity about the sexual feelings of the people you love is some good stuff. It is some juicy stuff. When I am turned on by someone, I want to know everything that turns that person on. There's a fabulous Steely Dong, Steely Dan song, Steely Dong. The Steely Dan is a dildo, so Steely Dong, where it's like, now you're going to tell me everything. Okay, so you cheated on me. Now I want to know all the dirty details. Let's go. Going to have fun with this. So one thing you might find is when you do that, when you cross that little non-existent Rubicon, is that this is some juicy, sweet, nourishing, spicy, interesting territory to explore, to really tune in to what, like, you got this person who turns you on and you love them and you think they're interesting and they're intelligent and they're hot and whatever else it may be. Well, what is it? What is it? What do you like? Like, what have you done that you thought was fun? What do you want to do that you haven't had the chance to do? Like, I don't know. Like I say, I'm my own category in some ways, but like when I love someone and I'm into someone sexually, I want to know their whole story. I don't want to know about just the part that's about me. Let's you know, read the whole book, have the whole experience. That could go on with this. What you can do with compersion, when you got it going, then you're free. Then you are free to experience your loved ones experiencing other people, which is where the word came from. In the C.T. Butler interview, I learned that the word compersion came from the Carista community, and I'm not sure C.T. was old enough to live in Carista, but he might have lived in Carista, one of the first polyamorous residential experiments in the Haight-Ashbury district in the 1970s in San Francisco. So C.T. is a bit older than me. He might have actually done that. He's done a lot of exciting things that he marveled at, was like, wow, that was even possible? Yeah. They found themselves having this feeling because they were having a lot of sexual experiments and group experiences and parties and threesomes and foursomes. When somebody was in love with someone and experiencing them having a loving erotic experience with another person, there's this really good feeling that was coming up. Where there should have been jealousy, there was this kind of celebration. Hello, Henrietta St. Francis. My beautiful old friend has walked into the room, wagging her tail, which is good these days. And they did the Ouija board. The most legit use of the Ouija board I've ever heard of. And they said, we need a word for this. What's the word for this? And the Ouija board spelled out compersion. C-O-M-P-E-R-S-I-O-N. So it has no actual etymology. It came out of a Ouija board, according to someone I consider a highly reliable source, Mr. C.T. Butler, author of the book Food Not Bombs. All right, so that's what I've got for you today. Just to remind you of my plans for next week, I will be doing a program about 9/11, so I'm going to dedicate myself to that. If you have thoughts, feelings, reflections, or audio you want to share, it could be you speaking, it can be audio samples. I'm going to, testify my personal 9/11 journey, what I experienced, what I went through, because I can tell you the most about what I've experienced, what I know, what I've learned as a journalist, looking into this for many years in many different ways with much help and the help of astrology. And there's a bit of Tantra Studio in there because there's one really good sex story that happens the week that I figured out 9/11, way back in March of 02, long ago, far away, on Maury Island, Washington, where the first Planet Waves office was. Okay, a pleasure as ever, and I'm going to leave you with a bit more Mickey Hart, Mickey of the Heart, and this is a twofer, Mysterious Island, Into Jerry, which I don't really need to explain to me, is a tribute to a person who was deeply respected by all the members of the Grateful Dead and the Grateful Dead family, John Jerome Garcia. All right, on that note, you know where to find me. Lots of love, and bye for now.